You may be escaping to it, or you may be escaping from it. We are, of course, talking about weather, and it's a major part of our lives. In fact, Mark Twain once wrote a book in which he purposefully left out the weather. This is to say, weather is so much a part of people's lives that leaving it out is humorous. Weather determines what you put on in the morning and how you cover yourself at night. It can literally be the difference between life and death, prosperity and ruin, or vacation and duress.
The weather is apple of contention. Everyone thinks or discusses the weather. I would wager that one could not enter into a conversation with anyone, regardless of whether they had known the person for a minute or for 50 years, without mentioning weather within the first 5 or 6 sentences. It's on everyone's mind. It has such a vast effect on everything that we do, both on a daily function as well as our economy. Droughts, floods, snowstorms all affect your ability to be able to harvest your crops, your ability to be able to place your manufactured product on some vehicle to send it to its market, all depend on what's going to happen to the weather.
That was Joseph Henry, who became the first secretary of the Smithsonian in 1846 and was a leading scientist of his day. Today, we're lucky enough to speak with him, or should I say, speak with a historic character as developed by the National Museum of American History's Theater Department. A little bit of background first. Joseph Henry took an interest in meteorology as a young man while a professor at the Albany Academy. He realized the high stakes of weather and the value of predicting it. And as the man who would become one of our nation's leading scientists, he wanted something a little more scientific than methods like the age-old goat system. Can't find your goat? They're probably hiding out. That means there's a good chance of rain. Goats are playing on the hill or the grassy knoll. You're probably in for a nice day.
My concern was that weather can dominate and also incapacitate us. And there must be a way in which to avoid the consequences or the calamities of weather. And when I was invited to become the first secretary of the Smithsonian in 1846, I put together what was called a programme d'organisation, which put forth the fact that I felt that our meteorology had to be on a more definite basis and that we needed to organize a system of more efficient means. And as I stated at that time, I am disposed to carry it out as far as our means will permit. And so, as I said, I called for a system of extended meteorological observations for solving the problems of American storms.
This, of course, begs the question, how can you solve the problem of American storms?
Well, as you may know, our weather prevails from the west and moves to the east. That is across the North American and Central American continent. And so, what weather is occurring to the west of us will many times arrive here within a matter of hours or days. I wanted to be able to give warning on the eastern coast of the approach of storms. I've often stated that if the station of Cincinnati was receiving rain at 7 o'clock in the morning, a rainstorm might confidently be expected at Washington at about 7 in the evening. You're probably asking yourself, well, how did we receive the information? That was primarily through and because of the wonderful advancements of something called the telegraph. I'd like to give the example of the message of President Washington's passing. It took 10 days to come from Washington, D.C. to Albany, New York. Whereas by the time we started the weather service, I could know what was happening in Albany, New York by a telegram within a matter of hours.
Telegraph companies and their operators sent the information at little or no cost out of a sense of civic duty. But they weren't normally the ones collecting the information. This data was collected by volunteers, and Joseph Henry had as many as 600 of them, including people in Canada, Latin America, and the Caribbean.
It was primarily the scientific community. And people of like interest and knowledge are quite eager to exchange information in order to advance themselves and others. So this is how it began. And so Many of my contacts would send me requests to be part of the system, and it just grew entropically along the way. We sent them a lot of instruments. They were the instruments that were the most advanced at the time. Obviously, as I referred to somewhat earlier, how does one calculate weather? Well, one would be the wind. The wind speed and the wind direction mean so much to us. So we would make sure that people were sent weather vanes, but not just weather vanes, but something called anemometers, which are small cups that are placed on the axis of a weather vane that would turn with the wind, and then one would use a watch, a pocket watch, to calculate what speed the wind was doing and what the direction was. And both with the wind and the other elements I'm going to discuss, we also established a standard of making the measurements at 8 in the morning and at 4 in the afternoon. And that's so much of what science is all about, is to organize and to have a system that means the same for all so that you can interpret it. Precipitation would, of course, be something of interest, and that would be what is used as a rain gauge, which we've had since the 1600s. And again, it would be a matter of having a container to receive the fall of rain over a certain time period from 8 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon. Barometric or atmospheric pressure was another. This barometer resembled a teapot or a teacup, and it had a spout, and there was usually either some heavy water or eventually mercury that would move up and down, indicating what the atmospheric pressure was and the change of weather. And speaking of mercury, but at that time we also had thermometers. And the last one of the elements that we really were quite interested in was humidity, or the amount of air and water combined. And there had been a way of calculating humidity for many, many years by the use of human hair. And I will say to you, if you take a person, particularly with light-colored hair, and the air is more humid, what does that hair do? It becomes frizzy or curls. It indicates the higher amount of humidity.
With 600 volunteers regularly sending weather data by 1860, Joseph Henry was faced with a Herculean task, analyzing it. To Henry, this was a worthwhile venture, worth $4,400 in 1860 alone, to be specific, 30% of the annual research and publication budget of the Smithsonian at the time. But this was worth it to him because Henry thought the best way to know what will happen is by having a good record of what has happened. Clearly, to accomplish this, he needed help. Henry contracted with James H. Coffin, a professor of mathematics and natural philosophy at Lafayette College in Easton, Pennsylvania. Coffin himself had to employ up to 15 what we would call human calculators to make useful information out of the up to 500,000 separate observations a year. This data was eventually published in a 2-volume compilation of climatic data and storm observations. Starting in 1856, weather data was also publicly presented in another fashion, on a map with colored disks indicating weather conditions.
This map was mounted for public display at the Smithsonian Institution in 1856, and my stated purpose was to show at one view the meteorological condition of the atmosphere over the entire country. And I used colored disks to indicate those conditions. White was sunny, black was rain, blue was snow, and brown was cloudy. And also I found that my visitors to the institution all appeared to be specifically interested in knowing the condition of weather to which their friends at home are subject at the time. And so it became a very popular activity to come to the Smithsonian Institution and to observe the weather throughout North and Central America.
Weather information proved so popular and useful that it began to appear in the newspaper, first in the Washington Evening Star in May of 1857. But this trend grew, giving rise to the now common weather section.
A telegraph operator, say, in Cincinnati, Ohio, when he would open his office at 7 in the morning, the first thing he would send is wind from the west at 12 miles an hour, rainfall of 1 inch, and partial sun. And that would go from his station to the next telegraph station, and that would be repeated and would be forwarded. And along the way, there would be what are referred to as runners from the newspaper offices that would pick up that information from the telegraph operators and take it to their publishers. And that would be published whatever the newspaper was of that particular city. You have to bear in mind that in 1856 there was really no national newspaper. So everyone relied upon the local newspapers for their information.
Henry hoped to create an efficient and effective storm warning system for the Eastern Seaboard. But he wasn't able to accomplish this on the scale that he hoped for due to other pressing national concerns, the Civil War. Henry's weather system took a back seat to war-related telegraph transmissions, such as troop movements. But he was still occasionally called upon to provide weather predictions for military operations, which he did to the extent possible, given that many telegraph lines were destroyed in the South and North due to tactical reasons and sabotage. When the war ended in 1865, the Smithsonian was able to return to a more normal operation. But Joseph Henry thought that Congress should establish a national weather service capable of accomplishing on a large scale what he had set out to do before the Civil War.
It was, from its inception, a very important concept. If we can avoid the calamities of storms and give any prior notice to the residents of any area that there will be destruction, damage of life and limb, and that one can take action to avoid that, we will be better off and we will be in better condition to embrace the future. And this is something that has to be maintained always, and hopefully that this will be expanded. I've often said that as far as the entire scientific process goes, that there are many more things in heaven and earth that have yet to be discovered than we've even dreamt of at this point.
This was eventually accomplished. The U.S. Army Signal Service took over storm and weather predictions in 1870 and the entire volunteer observer system in 1874. And in 1891, the U.S. Weather Bureau was founded. This organization would eventually be renamed what we know it as today, the National Weather Service, which still uses the same fundamental structures and principles as a system created by Joseph Henry during his tenure as the Smithsonian's first secretary. For the History Explorer podcast, this is Matt Hoffman. Thank you for listening. This podcast was funded through a generous grant from the Verizon Foundation. I'd like to offer a special thanks to Dwayne Starlin for his masterful portrayal of Joseph Henry.